is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grillion Bunker, welcome again, one and all, to the Grillion Report. I am your host, Micah Hanks. On our new home at the KGRA Radio Network, glad to be with you as always. And here in studio with me, as always, we have our producer and co-host, Mr. Chris Hayes. Good evening. How are you, sir?
I'm quite well. Right as rain, even.
Right as rain. That's a good thing to be. Although, the sun never sets, nor does it ever rise, and hence, there's never rain here in the bunker, which I will affirm with my younger brother and partner in crime, Mr. Caleb Hanks, behind the Grillion Report Master Console. Good evening, Caleb.
Good evening.
Good to see you here, friend, and good to see all of you out there. Of course, we've got a wide variety of people who have been flooding into the chat room there at grillionreport.com/podcast and radio. For all you fine folks who like to time travel instead and be able to revisit what happened on Monday nights from 7 to 9 p.m., and you're downloading this via the World Wide Web and listening as a podcaster, hello to you just as well. Tonight, we've got a lot we're going to get to, including a skeptic who may have had a change of heart. This is no doubt going to be one of the big stories of the year. But first, here's what's happening just a little south, maybe a little south of sanity, according to residents of Atlanta who are reporting that a mysterious noise is plaguing a Northwest community. Now, that's Northwest Atlanta, keep in mind. And it's actually literally keeping some people awake at night. It sounds like a tornado siren, roughly, according to one neighbor. Since it started about 6 weeks ago, folks in three different developments along Marietta Road in Northwest Atlanta say that they've heard a mysterious noise which apparently no one can seem to identify. Nobody knows what this is. Now, Anna Wagner, one of the area locals who was interviewed about this, according to WSBTV.com, had said that we are hearing sirens maybe 10 times a day, late at night, and at all hours. Sirens. And Wendell Burke similarly said it can go off at 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m., and you don't know what it might be. Now, Atlanta Councilwoman Felicia Moore says on her Facebook page recently that it has been blowing up with people posting about their concerns. They want to know what this noise is. She estimated that the sounds can be heard by more than 1,000 people in the DuPont Commons, Adams Crossing, and Hills Park neighborhoods. She says, I'm irritated, and I'm taking my irritation to the rail yard, and they're saying that they don't know what's going on, so they say it isn't the rail yard that's causing this. Law enforcement can't seem to figure out what it is either. Moore complains that we are stuck right now trying to figure out where this noise is coming from, who is responsible, and most importantly, how we might be able to stop it. Now, some neighbors report that the sound is coming from what they believe, again, to be a nearby railroad identified as CSX Railroad. A representative with CSX, however, has said that there are currently investigations underway. They, too, say that this is a mystery. And according to one spokesperson, we've had someone contact CSX. They claim nothing has changed over at the yard. We'd like to get to the bottom of it ourselves. So what is going on? Now, anyone who is familiar with what we call the Twilight Realm of Fortiana knows well that in the realm of the unexplained, there is a common history of reports of strange noises. The American physicist William R. Corliss even wrote about the number of strange reports of noises of unexplained origin that seem to emanate from all kinds of places. They're even, and this is interesting because I've got a friend who had sent me some data about this a while back. There are recollections of reports of things that sound like, get this, pipe organs emanating from deep beneath the earth. Sounds like something out of, well, you want to guess, Chris?
Well, I would just like to apologize to the people of Atlanta. I'm sorry. I've just been practicing.
Yeah, exactly. There it is. I was going to say.
I've got to get my Phantom of the Opera shtick down for next year's Halloween, so the good organ is part of it.
Did you get that instructional Eddie Munster video? Or was that yours?
Yeah, no, I got
you
it.
You left it at the... Okay, cool.
Yeah, no, I got it.
You too. You got the Phantom of the Opera reference, by the way. Spot on there, chum.
If you could see me, I'm Lon Chaney now.
I was going to say, we've got a regular Lon Chaney right here in the studio. Oh, goodness. You guys are so smart. You guys must be on smart pills. And it's fortunate because it's apparently official now that stupid may be a disease after all. That would explain a lot, wouldn't it? But I'm not kidding. I only wish I were. Now, a virus that infects human brains and turns them into pudding and makes us more stupid has actually been discovered, according to scientists in the United States. That's right. A study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences has detailed that is, again, this is something that was actually found virtually by accident, but it's an algae virus never before observed in healthy people, had been found and is actually believed to be able to affect cognitive functions, including visual processing and spatial awareness. Now, here's how this was accidentally found. This is very interesting. Scientists at Johns Hopkins Medical School and the University of Nebraska were involved with an unrelated study into throat microbes. The researchers had found DNA in the throats of the healthy individuals that matched the DNA of a virus known to infect green algae. Now, this is a striking example showing that the innocuous microorganisms we carry can affect behavior and cognition, according to virologist Dr. Robert Yolkin, one of the leaders of the study. Now, he said many physiological differences between person A and person B, for instance, are encoded in the set of genes that each inherits from their parents. Yet, some of these differences are fueled by various microorganisms that we actually harbor and the way that they interact with our genes as individuals. Now, of the 90%, or rather the 90 participants in this study, there were 40 who actually tested positive for this algae virus. Again, something that was stumbled upon, had not been known to affect humans before this. 40 of 90 participants had tested positive for this virus. Those who tested positive performed worse on tests designed to measure the speed and the accuracy of their visual processing. They also achieved lower scores in tasks designed to measure attention. Now, human bodies contain trillions of bacteria, viruses, and fungi. Most are harmless, but the findings of this study really give us cause for pause, people, because some microbes can have a detrimental impact, apparently, on cognitive function while leaving essentially everything else in your body unharmed. So you can be a perfectly healthy individual, but you may not be processing, so to speak, as quickly as others, and it could actually have to do with microbial agents in your body, once believed only to affect algae. Isn't that interesting? That would explain a lot, and I mean that in no way is being a negative or a derogatory thing. I think that really it might excuse a lot of situations. I have a friend, as a matter of fact, who told me a while back that he had literally just felt brain dead for such a long time and felt that there was something. He said, I used to feel like I was such more, you know, so quick and so rapid fire about things. Something had obviously changed, and he changed his diet and began introducing vitamins B7 and a number of other supplements into his diet. And he said, all of a sudden, I literally overnight turned back to being me. And he said, I was convinced that there was something affecting my body. So what's even more interesting about this study, which apparently is not mentioned as the press discusses this, is if a person is found to actually test positive for the microbial agents once believed to only affect algae that can actually have a negative effect on cognition or cognitive function and general performance, visual processing, all these kinds of things that anyone from an airline pilot to a graphic artist might really need to be able to rely on, how do you get rid of it? Or can you get rid of this? Is this something that can be cured? That's a question. But that's very interesting that, yes, indeed, and of course, the press jumping all over this, the Independent in the UK had carried the story. Stupid may be a disease after all. I hope that that is treated in a very, very positive way and not merely as an anecdote. Because, again, 40 of 90 participants, we're talking about roughly half of the people who were tested in this study. Think about all the people out there who just say, gosh, I get home from work and I can't think, you know, there's like a big cloud in my head. You know what? That might be because there's an actual cloud in your head, for all you know.
There's apparently all kinds of things that can affect your cognitive ability, and some people theorize that Wi-Fi actually can affect your brain adversely, which is kind of odd, but yeah. Potentially believable.
No. I mean, Caleb, there are people who actually who retreat into the forests and into the hills and become forest people, ferals. No, in seriousness, what they are trying to escape is they're attempting to leave society where they feel that they're constantly bombarded by not only EMFs, but also public Wi-Fi. A lot of cities actually offer public Wi-Fi in downtown areas, and if you go into a city, you can't get away from it. Chris, you remember at the first Paradigm Symposium, Caleb, you probably remember this too, I had this constant, strange kind of an in-and-out thing going on where I was just, I mean, I felt like literally my whole body was moving, but I was standing still. And as soon as I left that hotel, at the First Paradigm Symposium and stepped outside into the open air of Minneapolis, all of a sudden I was like, oh, wow, and now it's gone. And I remember the final day I was there in St. Paul. Scotty and Dr. John and I, we all went walking around town together. And I remember thinking, you know, I feel completely fine, but the whole weekend in that hotel, I had this weird dizzy thing happening. And at one point, one of the helpers with the Paradigm Symposium brought me a glass of orange juice. They said, you're not eating, you're working, you're not eating, your blood sugar's dropping. I don't think that's what it was. And I've had that happen other times, but only when I go into big cities. And it literally, I can't help but wonder if it's not some sort of a strange electromagnetic interference. I like to put out questions to the audience from time to time about these kinds of things. We're going to be revisiting one of the questions we put out to the audience in recent weeks here in just a moment when we get to a few of our listener emails. But my question to you, the Graylian listenership this week, is if you ever, especially if you're someone who lives in the big city, if you ever experience an intermittent kind of a dizziness or kind of a sense that when you're standing still, you're still moving, anything kind of like that. Again, living out here in the country, I never experienced this. I never experienced this generally any place except for when I travel and go to speak at conferences in big cities and things like that. But do you guys remember me talking about that at the First Paradigm? Do either of you remember that?
Yeah, I remember a few people had actually said that they'd felt like the building itself was moving.
That's kind of the sense that I had. And my friend Jessalyn, who just emailed me today, she had said that she felt that what it actually was all the energy of all the people there together. I mean, who knows?
The building could have burst into flames.
Well, there was something going on, and I know I was able to sense it. But people who claim that they are sensitive to things like Wi-Fi and electromagnetic disturbance, you know, I wrote about in Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule, a condition called electrical hypersensitivity and multiple allergy syndrome that literally some people suffer from. And what this can tend to cause is it can cause all kinds of things like sleeplessness. People perceive that they may be accompanied in a room by an entity or a presence. You know, they get sick. They literally will have actually allergic type reactions to things such as proximity to electromagnetic fields produced by electrical equipment and devices. And I knew a woman here in this region whose house she believed was haunted. And she was well aware of the fact that she suffered from a variety of this. And she said, all the electrical equipment has to be on the opposite side of the house or I can't sleep at night. And I thought, you know, I don't think that your house or your property is haunted by any means. I think that you suffer from an actual condition, a recognized medical condition. I seem to think that Michael Persinger and others had written about that just as well in relation to what Billy Clark, our good friend, longtime listener, one of our loyalist listeners across the great and wide and salty Atlantic, who had written to me about recently, the God Helmet, these kinds of experiments. Interesting stuff. But I'm always interested in the way that electromagnetic equipment or fields might. It doesn't seem to affect everybody, but how it might affect certain individuals. I even experienced that from time to time myself. And one more thing, too, I'll just say, I can't hold a cell phone next to my head. I literally will start getting dizzy if I hold like an iPhone next to my head. I always, if you're going to talk to me, I'm always going to have earbuds in, or I'm going to have you on speakerphone, or I'll have you on the Bluetooth in my car while I'm driving. I will not hold a cell phone by my head, because not only are there all the studies that, you know, again, link cell phone use with possible tumors and things like that that can develop, but it literally, if I hold a phone too close to my head, I get dizzy. It's uncomfortable.
Yeah, after years of having the iPhone 5S in my pocket, I am now sterile.
Ah, well, there you go. Good thing or a bad thing? I'm not really sure. I said we had some listener emails I thought we'd get to. Guys, one of the things that, well, actually, we'll touch on that in a minute, because I want to come back around to a little game we played with our listeners, Caleb and I, on Halloween night. But first, I wanted to come around to an email written. We got a lot of helpful feedback from people this week. And Georgie writes, in addition to having sent along a couple of cannibal stories, which kind of touched on the subject that we addressed on Halloween, he said, I also want to ask you about a case that happened in the past. Now, I often don't have time to write everyone back. Georgie, if you're hearing this, I do want to write you back. Just haven't had time yet, but I hope you don't mind me reading this, because I think our listenership may be able to help him. I'm interested in hearing more about what he wrote me about, and I did not have an answer, so we put it out to the listeners. He said, I want to ask you about a case that happened a few years ago. Can you help me? I just need the name of the case, and I can find the rest. As far as I remember, it happened 20 or 30 years ago, probably in Scandinavia, but possibly more specifically in Finland. Now, a group of friends was camping one night in the woods. On the morning when it arrived, all were dead except for only one, who was actually sent to prison for murder. But there are some strange details about this story, and some actually speculate that there was a local legend about a monster that may have been involved as well. He writes, I know that there is such a case, but I can't find it because whenever I type in, for instance, in a search with Google, you know, hikers who were killed, it always brings back research results for the more famous Dyatlov Pass incident. Hope you can help me with best wishes. I, unfortunately, Georgie, do not know the answer to that, but if anyone out there in the listenership happens to know this case that involved a group of hikers or campers, all of whom were killed, somehow one remained the following morning. This person may have been incarcerated, but there was a story of a local monster involved. We'd love to hear from you. info@graylianreport.com. That's how you can reach us. Brian writes, hey, Micah, I just downloaded your Halloween episode, and you guys talked about how adults are spending even more on their costumes this year than kids. Well, I was definitely guilty of that this year. Below, you'll see me and two friends dressed up as characters from one of the best sci-fi flicks of the past few decades, The Fifth Element. I figured I'd send it over. Great show. Look forward to the next episode. That was Brian Drummond who sent that. And I have to say, Brian, your costume was awesome. He went as Ruby Rod, the character that was it Chris Tucker that played him?
Yeah, that's really funny because as soon as you said The Fifth Element, image of Lilu popped up on my phone.
Synchronicity. My friends, synchronicity in the bunker tonight. Well, the other two folks in the picture were actually Lilu Dallas and, well, not really her last name, but presumed for her Lilu Dallas multipass, you'll remember. And then, of course, the main protagonist. What was his name in the film?
Who? Bruce Willis?
Yeah.
Corbin Dallas.
Corbin Dallas. That's right. I shouldn't have forgotten that. Excellent Halloween costumes, by the way. Almost as good as our friends a few years ago who won a ticket to the First Paradigm Symposium by dressing as literally stormtroopers and I think an Imperial Guard holding copies of Intrepid magazine. We get some great costumes sent in to the fine folks here at the Graylian. Thanks for that, Brian. We really enjoyed those. And speaking of Halloween, this is what I wanted to get around to. Now, Caleb and I had played a game on the air on Halloween, for our Graylian Halloween episode. And that game was as follows. Pick a celebrity, pick your favorite Fortean researcher, and then I want you to take the first letter of your last name and match that to a lawn or garden utility with the same first letter, and then put together your zombie hunting team and your weapon based on this. Beth Arzy writes, of course, longtime listener of the friend, dear friend of ours in the UK. She says, my celebrity would be Dan Aykroyd. My favorite researcher, well, Micah Hanks. How about that? And she says, my weapon would be an axe. She says, we've got a medical professional on board, Dr. McCoy, our warrior. Again, we kind of elucidated that there were archetypes that appear in a lot of zombie films, so she took it a little further. Dr. McCoy was the medical professional. The warrior would be Daryl from The Walking Dead, and their location would be Shetland. She says, I chose Micah for multiple brain uses, and when the inevitable happens, he's pretty and will make for good eating. Well.
And congratulations on that music video, Beth. Looked great.
That's right. She sent us a care package a while back, in fact, that included, of all things, a diary that is made to look like a TARDIS on the outside. That was a wonderful gift. Thank you so much, Beth, and thanks for writing. Steven also writes from Arkansas. He said, love the zombie discussion. Here's my zombie team. My celebrity would be Shia LaBeouf. My favorite researcher that would be on the team would be Richard Dolan, who actually will be broadcasting live tonight immediately after us here on the KGRA. He says, since my last name starts with a U, I couldn't think of a tool starting with that letter, so instead I'll go with a ukulele. We're dead already. Keep up the good work. Jeffrey Kendall also wrote, he says, my celebrity would be Bruce Campbell. He says, my researcher would be Lyle Blackburn. My tool would be a Kaiser blade. I think I'd fare pretty well. And you know what? We think so, too. Good job, Jeff, Stephen, and Beth for writing. We appreciate all you guys. Lindsay Morrison sent me one just as well, and I wanted to acknowledge her because Lindsay and I met for dinner just a few nights ago when she was in town. Unfortunately, I could not find the email, and the only reason why is probably because I get so many emails from her because she is every single day devoted to helping us put together our daily news roundups at graylianreport.com. And so if you're not already checking those out, visit www.graylianreport.com and you can literally see updated news from around the world that deals with science, technology, weird stuff, Fortiana, UFOs. Lindsay contributes so much, and thank you so much, Lindsay. And either way, I think it's pretty much a given. I'd be on your zombie team, okay? Before we go to break, I've got just a couple others I wanted to touch on. I put out another question to our listenership a while back. I wanted to know if anyone knew specifically the quote from Carl Sagan, because I've heard this for years that he had actually said that there may be some merit to past lives, or belief in, or maybe at least the potential that they could be studied with some promising results. Well, Darren writes, I'm just listening to this week's podcast and wanted to give you the source of the Sagan quote. I'm imagining I'm not the first to point it out. Actually, Darren, you were. Thank you so much. But he said, on the off chance that I'm not, the quote is from The Demon Haunted World, a book that I've probably owned more than one copy of over the years, and I got one in there right now. Page 302 or thereabouts, the full quote is as follows. He says, perhaps at 1%, well, actually, you know what would be funny is to read this in the voice of Carl Sagan. Perhaps 1% of the time, I'm not going to read the entire thing, sorry.
That was Kermit the Frog.
We're made of star stuff. But he says that perhaps 1% of the time, someone who has an idea that smells, feels, and looks indistinguishable from the usual run of pseudoscience will turn out to be right. Maybe some undiscovered reptile left over from the Cretaceous period will indeed be found in Loch Ness or the Congo Republic. Or maybe we'll find artifacts of an advanced non-human species elsewhere in the solar system. At the time of writing, there are three claims in the ESP field which, in my opinion, deserve serious study. One, that by thought alone, humans can barely, but nonetheless possibly, affect random number generators in computers. Two, that young children sometimes report the details of a previous life which, upon checking, turn out to be accurate and which they could not have known about in any other way than reincarnation. Or as Whovians might say, of course, regeneration. And that three, people under mild sensory deprivation can receive thoughts or images projected at them. He says, I pick these claims not because I think that they're likely to be valid, I don't, but as examples of contentions that might be true. The last three have at least some, although still dubious, experimental support, and of course I could be wrong. Now, Darren follows up and says it's not so much that Sagan believed in past lives. It was an example of areas that, while unlikely to be true, maybe deserved more serious study. I found your podcast via Jim Harold. I've been enjoying it so far. Thanks, Darren. And Darren, thank you. And I want to mention, by the way, in relation to those three points, thought alone might be utilized by humans to barely affect random number generators in computers. Young children might report details of a previous life. And people under mild sensory deprivation can receive thoughts or images projected at them. We've got a couple of news stories on the next side of this break that I want to touch on that actually deal with very similar subjects. And I'm going to tell you, Sagan may not have lived to see them, but we're getting very close to functional extrasensory perception and maybe even medical science that could be utilized in what we could call actual regeneration. We'll talk about all that when we come back here on the Graylian Report. Just when the lovely Lady Arzy over in the UK thought she'd get away with only one mention on the program. That is Beth Arzy right there. Helen Reddy, of course, the song right there. Love her stuff, and it's always so nice to hear her lovely singing voice just as well. Now, coming back to Carl Sagan, as we discussed in this last segment, one of the other things I should point out that he mentioned, by the way, was maybe there will be some sort of a dinosaur kind of like thing discovered in Loch Ness. Now, that still seems pretty unlikely to me, but there is a new video that has appeared. TheInquisitor.com carried this. What is described as an anomaly filmed recently using an iPhone in Loch Ness. It's an anomaly that I can't really explain. I'm a bit of a doubter of a lot of things until I see it myself, and I wouldn't have believed what I saw if someone else wasn't telling me, according to Richard Collis, a 58-year-old tree planter who took the video and who also says that he was fished or has fished in Loch Ness since childhood and never experienced any sighting of anything like what he saw last week. Now, I don't really believe in anything like that until I see it, but what I saw was obviously what the Loch Ness monster is. Now, he had reported, apparently, to the Daily Record that I'm not saying it was a fire-breathing dragon and I never saw teeth or anything like that, but I must have thought that there was something there if I stopped to take these pictures, which is actually, again, a video. Now, the new video appears just days after a photo purporting to show the creature poking its head through the waves of Loch Ness was revealed at a paranormal conference in Scotland. So there's been all kinds of buzz overseas about an ancient monster that may inhabit Loch Ness. But, you know, I'll put it to you guys, Graylian gang. How likely do you think it is that there could actually be some sort of a monstrosity that still inhabits Loch Ness, or ever did? Could there ever really have been a monster in Loch Ness? Is there compelling evidence to support something like that, or is this, as Sagan might have said, a highly dubious claim?
I heard a song when I was a young man that, in my opinion, is what the Loch Ness monster is, and it goes a little something like this. It's log, it's log, it's big, it's heavy, it's wood. It's log, it's log, it's better than bad, it's good.
Sing it if you know it. I'll tell you what, that's what this video looks like to me. It looks like a stick or something like that protruding from the water. But I will say this.
The Loch Ness Monster.
The Loch Ness Monster.
That's what they initially called it.
Yeah. I will say this, though, that I've tried to film, you know, something from a distance with an iPhone before. And yeah, it's about as, you know, much clarity as trying to stare at the sun through a pie plate. You're not going to really succeed at, you know, really capturing the essence unless you're right up on something if you're trying to film it with an iPhone. And so it very well may have been that whatever this man was seeing was something that appeared far more remarkable to the naked eye than it did to the eye on his iPhone. Chris, do you buy it? Do you think that a Loch Ness monster could really exist?
No. Not at all.
Come on, I value your skeptical opinion on this. I want to hear a little bit more. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, there's no way based on the Loch borders that something like that could get in from the ocean, and it would need to get in and out of the lock in order to maintain a food source, because there's not enough food source in the lock to sustain something stuck in there. However, there was one really good theory brought forth, and it's that the Loch Ness Monster is in fact a sturgeon, a very old sturgeon. And sturgeons do routinely live to 150, 200 years.
Oh, even older than that.
They get immense.
They do.
Like the size of a city bus, immense.
Yeah, they can get extremely large. You know, the thing I would say about this is that with regard to the Loch Ness Monster, first of all, if they're a giant sturgeon in the loch, well, that's what they're eating. Second of all, no, I'm kidding, actually.
Just ask Larry King. He was around when they were all being born.
Yeah, right. No, Caleb, you're talking about the late Cretaceous.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I was a period off.
Yes, you were. Yeah, one or two, in fact, actually. He might have been born in the Jurassic. I'm not sure.
Tonight, Ron Paul's, I guess. Tonight, my shoulders will surpass my forehead.
Yes. I can't wait until artificial intelligence kicks in and we actually have cybernetics and things that can be used to keep him alive. We're going to have Larry King in the year 2027. 2027. Maybe even further than that, because that's not that far away. But, yeah, you know, yeah. In the year 2000. Ladies and gentlemen, we're looking ahead in the year 2000.
I mean, I think Larry King and Yoda are roughly the same age.
That's right, yes. Oh, I saw the best GIF the other day, by the way.
In 800 years you are. Look this way, you will.
And then David Tennant pops up. Ha-ha, oh, really? That was pretty good. I'm just not buying it. I don't think this video is really showing the Loch Ness Monster. That's just my take. I think it's probably a stick or a twig or something, but who knows, because the iPhone maybe isn't doing it the most justice. But there was another announcement made about a similar story. I believe that the creature in Lake Champlain, I believe, is the object of the story that was brought to light. Dread saying it, but I'm not going to name the video site, but there's a popular paranormal video site that had a link about this. So I dug around, and sure enough, other news agencies were reporting that some researchers now believe that there is at least what they think is decent circumstantial evidence that supports the idea that there may have been belugas or some other kind of a whale-like animal present in the vicinity, rather than there being some sort of a lake monster akin to a plesiosaur. It is interesting, I will note, that coming back to Loch Ness, the reports of the plesiosaur-like animal all kind of took place around the 1930s and 40s, you know, the Spicer sighting. There were a number of sightings of strange things seen, and they really began to taper off over the decades. There certainly are pretty decent videos of maybe things in the loch, but nothing that really supports the idea of a dinosaur-like creature. And again, I'd come back to what Chris said. Probably sturgeon is the best explanation for what was seen, apart from maybe a few people and their imaginations.
Well, Red Pill Junkie was saying in the chat room, problem with the sturgeon theory is all the land sightings of the Loch Ness Monster. And I remember a couple of stories back in the day talking about like a kind of leathery gray thing struggling down into the water. I mean, that to me sounds like a damn walrus.
It sounded a lot like a walrus, except for the fact that the thing was described as having a long neck with a head on the end. Again, I think that was the Spicer sighting. They were driving along at night, yeah. And the thing was illuminated in the headlights, and they said that this whatever this creature was trying to get across the road in front of them and get down to the shore again. So there have been some credible reports, and yeah, good point, that the few credible reports from that era that we deal with actually had a lot more to do with things that were seen on land, not in water.
Yeah. See, I almost kind of tend to think that sometimes people's perception of the weirdness surrounding the Loch, even as far as, like, I don't know, witchcraft potentially being...
Well, how would you tie witchcraft in with that?
Mr. Crowley, of course.
Oh, well, that's an interesting point. Yeah, you remember that?
But okay, I'm just saying, like, I think that people's minds might mildly distort things like that if they had pre-existing knowledge of any sort of weird air about the Loch itself. And let's just say, for some reason, somehow a walrus did get to Loch Ness and was struggling across the pond there. You know, I've seen some weird stuff crossing the road at night, and in my mind, sometimes it becomes a little bit more distorted than it actually was. And I think humans have a tendency to kind of let their minds run a little bit in the nighttime when they're not exactly comfortable. So I kind of try to think, okay, you know, maybe they did see something, but highly doubtful it's a frickin' plesiosaur.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. And I want to come back to something that you alluded to, the Crowley connection with Loch Ness. Chris, do you remember this? Are you familiar with this?
Not a bit, no.
Okay, there'd been a home owned by the famous, notorious magician Aleister Crowley called Boleskine House, and that house had actually been on the shore of Loch Ness, and he had considered this kind of the Mecca of Thelema, the religion that he had practiced, and he'd carried out a number of rituals there, but it was always supposed that Boleskine House itself was actually haunted by the severed head of a person who had died there. And Crowley eventually left the residence, but it was later purchased by famous rock guitarist Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin. And he also attested to the fact that the house seemed to be haunted by the ghost of a severed head that would appear particularly in the kitchen. One can use their imagination about how a severed head might, you know, involve itself in locomotion, but I digress. But there have been, you know, very, very, very anecdotal references made over the years that, you know, Crowley had actually gone to Boleskine House because at this location by the Loch, he could summon and commune with the creature telepathically and all this sort of stuff.
I love you!
Yeah, there was that. I don't remember the science fiction author, but there was a great series of short stories that was published by an author a few years ago called, it was published under the title Love Not Human, and the picture on the cover of the mass market paperback that I actually own was the Loch Ness Monster carrying a diver in its mouth, saving the diver. And there was a great story about a little colony of Loch Ness monsters that existed there in the Loch, but they were intelligent and they could communicate with one another.
If anybody knows anything about Love Not Human, it's Crowley.
Crowley would know all about that.
With what was his name? Lot? No, it wasn't Lot. Who was the...
Okay, we're going to talk about Lot.
No, who was
Lamb?
Lamb.
Well, I
Lom. Lom. I'm sorry. Whatever.
Yeah, I always say Lom. Yes, you guys are good. These guys are so good.
Hey, hang out with you long enough, you get to pick up some stuff.
That's right. Yeah, I say Lom because, again, he's said that that was from the Tibetan word lam, as in lama, the prefix there. Lam meaning a path or the way to goeth. And actually, our good buddy who's been a guest on the program a few times, actually, we should get him back at some point, but Saraya, of course, of the Where Did the Road Go podcast, he pointed out to me that he believed that this was less an interpretation of some sort of a, you know, mystical being or an alien, as some people, Andrew or Daniel Budelian, I think, is the researcher in modern times that has drawn the parallel between the Lom representation drawn by Crowley and modern aliens abductee lore. No, Soraya pointed out to me, he says it was actually believed that that was a self-portrait of a sort that Crowley did, maybe his ethereal self. I'll have to have him on sometime to actually explain that a little, because I am fascinated with Crowley and kind of the cult of personality that has continued to, historically and otherwise, surround that individual. So that was one thing that I wanted to come to with regard to the points made by Carl Sagan in that relevant portion from the book that that Darren had sent along to us. Again, thanks for that, Darren, because it makes for great fodder for conversation. Another one, though, had been that while we talk about reincarnation, this doesn't have so much to do with reincarnation, but the idea of actual medical regeneration. For instance, many animals are actually capable, and more, you know, more so than and to greater degrees than humans are, of healing themselves, down to the actual ability of regeneration. You lop the, you know, the limb off of a starfish and it'll grow right back. The one that always fascinated me was simple life forms like planarians, you know, the little worms that live in lakes and ponds. If you take a planarian's head and slice it down the middle, each half of the head will grow a new half and you'll have a two-headed planarian. You cut a planarian down the middle lengthwise and the thing can actually grow a new half of its body in some instances, and actually you'll have two planarians. I mean, this is a very, very simple life form. Humans obviously couldn't do this. About the extent to which we can regenerate is the tip of a finger.
And these little planariums were doing that before Monsanto.
Exactly. Yeah, before we introduced GMOs into our diet. But what if I told you that scientists were working on ways to actually help humans do the same sorts of things that maybe a lizard would do when they lose a tail and they grow it back, or other kinds of animals, you know, insects and things that would lose a limb and could literally grow that back. Hell, some animals can literally replace organs if necessary. Well, humans have what are called homologs of many of the genes used to make these repairs like other animals. Most of ours begin to slow down, however, right after we're born, when all of our body parts are essentially done forming in the womb. Now, upon reaching adulthood, humans aren't just really all that great at repairing injured tissues because the genes that know how to rebuild themselves aren't being expressed the same way that they were when we were, again, in our formative stages prior to being born. Well, apparently there was a study carried out recently that is suggesting that there may be new advances medically that will really change what we think we know about regeneration. Organ regeneration is a fascinating phenomenon that seemingly recapitulates the processes observed during development. Now, this is a quote from Dr. Juan Carlos Belmont of Salk Institute. He said, however, despite our current understanding of how embryogenesis and development proceeds, the mechanisms preventing regeneration in adult mammals have remained elusive. Now, again, Juan Carlos Belmont of the Salk Institute's been working for about a decade on trying to identify the molecular mechanisms necessary to regenerate injured cardiac cells, this embryogenesis that he's talking about. Now, in his lab, he has shown that it can actually be accomplished in live mice. This proof of principle demonstration could eventually lead to new treatments for cardiac patients and a way literally to heal a broken heart. I mean, a physically broken one. Now, in his lab, Belmonte discovered in 2003 that a certain signaling pathway preceded cardiac tissue regeneration. The process was fully explained in a paper published in 2010. His team discovered that injured heart cells weren't healed through stem cells, but by cardiac cells, they were actually de-differentiated. Now, they were more like precursor cells. The next logical question would be whether this could be achieved in mammals. But Belmonte says that he actually had to tread very carefully about this because, and this is interesting, again, Sagan's whole points earlier about pseudoscience and the way that you are treated in the community if you come forward with a bold claim, very same sort of thing. He says when you speak about these things, the first thing that comes to people's mind is that you are crazy. It is a strange-sounding idea, since we associate regeneration with salamanders and fish and things like this, but not with mammals. Now, this all has to do with what are called microRNAs, molecules that assist in post-transcriptional gene regulation, which were used to identify four molecules that were highly suppressed during the regeneration of cardiac cells in zebrafish in certain studies, but are also found in rodents and humans. Now, testing with live mice, as we mentioned, in cultured human heart tissue as well, has apparently revealed in certain studies that Belmonte and his team have been working on that mammals did not shut off those microRNAs following cardiac injury like zebrafish do. However, when those microRNAs were artificially repressed in the mouse model following a heart attack, the cardiac cells reverted back to a de-differentiated state like the zebrafish. In other words, the mice were able to repair the damage with less scarring and with better blood flow than in control groups. Now, up to 6 months after the treatment, the differences between the two groups were still obvious, and an average life expectancy of a lab mouse is about 2 years, but this was still an incredible long-term result for mice. So going forward, Belmonte actually hopes to replace these and replicate these same results in larger hearts and for even longer periods of time, maybe even human hearts.
That's I've had my second strangeness of the evening happen when you were talking about that the doctor had discovered this in 2003. Literally, as you were saying 2003, the year pops up on my phone, 2003, because I was looking up Ang Lee's The Hulk. I don't know if you remember this, but in that movie, the plot line, Nick Nolte was doing the exact same thing where he was basically trying to splice the genetics of a starfish that could regrow its limbs.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And so I don't know if this is necessarily an instance where maybe they had read a story and put that into the movie, but one of those instances where science fiction is kind of maybe potentially influencing, you know, science fact. But I just thought that was kind of bizarre that that kind of all came together around the same time. Maybe it was a popular study, maybe that was in the news, but kind of strange anyway.
That is a pretty interesting parallel right there. How come, Chris, we don't ever have synchronicities like that happen?
Well, I don't feel synchronicities are a little more private.
Oh, know? Are they? Shh, say no more. I mean, no, I'm kidding.
I'm too connected to the machine. Me and the computer are one.
That's right. Yeah, this is what it all has to do with right here is the Secret Society's handbook. I'm not kidding. People at home, I'm actually holding a copy of what is known here around the bunker as the Secret Society's handbook. No, not a handbook to the world's most secret society, all you Middle Theory listeners out there. This is actually Michael Bradley's book, The Secret Society's Handbook, that literally basically blows the lid on every secret society ever presumed to exist, the ones you're not supposed to know about. But the world's most secret society is not mentioned in here. The Machiavellian Order was omitted. A little proud of that.
You prince.
Yes, you're such a prince, I know. And I actually am, apparently.
Actually, the artist formerly known as Prince, who is now the artist formerly known as the artist known as Prince.
That's right. Yeah, boy, I can't keep up with all his nicknames, so he must have regenerated. When we come back, we're going to pick up the rest of the weird news. Before we get into, I think we're going to have to save it for next hour, the story about the prominent skeptic. I'll go ahead and tell you his name, Michael Shermer, who has discussed having his own unique paranormal experience that may have changed his mind. We'll get into that a little later. More news of the weird when we come back on the other side. It is the Grayling Report with Micah, Caleb, and Chris. We'll be right back. Mountains of Appalachia. It is the Grayling Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, where we come together every week to discuss various sundry things. Here in a moment, we're going to get a little bit into the idea that neuroscientists may have discovered ESP. Another thing that Sagan had said maybe somebody would do. Unfortunately, he didn't live to see it. But if the singularitarians have anything to do with it, guys, well, they'll just bring Sagan back from the dead and he'll get to relive it all over again. And here I was putting together my ideas about ESP and the future of it during this last segment. And as we were getting ready to come back, Caleb and Chris were here in the studio talking about something entirely different. Why are you guys talking about Godzilla? Oh, I know. It's because when you live in a bunker underground like we all do, well, first of all, you never get a tan. And second of all, you're obviously hiding from giant ground-dwelling beasts above ground.
And apparently behind the power curve. I just saw this movie from Japan, this Godzilla movie. So good.
A new one?
Well, I mean, it's new to me.
Oh.
Is this the one that had the, what's his name, the Breaking Bad star?
Gilbert Godzilla?
Yeah.
No, it looked like, you know, a guy crushing all these little tiny buildings.
Yeah.
It was black and white. I mean,
oh.
I'm sure we're about a decade probably late.
Chris, after being held captive by Hadals for a decade, he's catching up on his movie going.
He's basically Brendan Fraser from Blast of the Past right now.
He just saw Dr. Strangelove for the first time ever. Yeah. How was it, by the way?
I fell in love.
I bet you did, yeah, as the name says. Well, you know, I knew that already because I happened to actually be able to utilize extrasensory perception to be able to, you know, find these kinds of things out. But is that a good thing? Is knowing, full knowing, a good thing? I asked the same question about time travel, and at mysteriousuniverse.com, or I'm sorry, .org, let me get my dots right. Later this week, I'm actually going to have a full review because the fine folks there at MU have mentioned that we from time to time feature entertainment subjects there at the site. And there was a great response a while back prior to Doctor Who Season 8 coming out, or Series 8, rather, featuring Peter Capaldi. the brilliant Scottish actor, and I'm more and more impressed with that guy as time goes on. We got a good response about a pre-series launch article I did about the dark new face of Capaldi's Doctor, you know, this new attitude he was going to take with the character. And so we've done a Series 8 wrap-up with the... We haven't seen the Christmas episode yet, but there certainly has been the finale, which was really good. It got rave reviews. BBC and, of course, also a number of other media outlets were really talking about how good this finale was. But I've done a wrap-up, and if you want to see that, that's at mysteriousuniverse.org. Check that out. But again, I get into the same sort of an idea, because whether it be ESP, which allows us to see into the future, or actual time travel, where we travel into the future, there are a lot of moral consequences that come to mind about, well, what happens when you essentially have the power of all knowing? And frankly, I don't see a distinction between whether or not if you have a traveling blue box that you can jump into, you know, a police box, and you can go into the future or any place in space-time and be able to know that way, or if you have the power of perception, or in this case, extrasensory perception. But now, Singularity Hub, a news source that you don't hear from an awful lot here on this program, but the one that I certainly follow all the time, reported this week that in the peripheral, the new stunner by cyberpunk godfather William Gibson, the reader is treated to a look at the future. It's an inexact future. The author delightfully gives us no date. Maybe it's 2080, maybe 3001. It's in the future at some point. But whatever the case, when Gibson talks tomorrow, it pays to pay attention today. And the reason why, Gibson is one of these few prophets whose vision has an overarching tendency towards to work like a tractor beam, drawing the wide open possibility field of now and directly toward the dead man's anchor of a very singular then. Now, what they're getting at in here is, of course, they're talking about the headline here, neuroscientists discovering ESP, but is that a good thing? It's often pointed out that Gibson is the man who invented cyberspace, but they say the more that Gibson did amounts to not just coming up with a great twist of words to note our online future again, but that he understood that the soul deep kinesthetic of cyberspace. He knew decades before most how cyberspace would feel and how it would make us feel. Now, I wonder sometimes if we really know what we think this is going to feel like in the future if we utilize technology to be able to utilize things like, for instance, what they're talking about here in this. That fact that neuroscientists apparently are capable of right now replicating what they're calling on par with ESP. An experiment that happens essentially like this. One participant, call them A, is connected to an EEG machine that reads neuroelectrical activity and sends corresponding pulses over the internet to a second participant, call them B. B is hooked up to a transcranial magnetic stimulation coil whose output is focused on the area of the brain that controls hand movements. Both A and B are playing a video game in which they're protecting a city against pirates by firing a cannon and shooting down rockets, only neither participant can see or rather can play the game alone. While A can see the screen and decide when to fire the cannon, that's all A can do. The touchpad that fires the cannon, however, and this is what's interesting, sits in B's domain. So A thinks about firing the cannon, and the signal is sent over the web where it hits the TMS device and causes B's hand to fire the cannon. Now, it's ESP that meets telepathy meets machine code, but it's also, unless I'm missing something, according to the author here at Singularity Hub, is the first step toward William Gibson's actual peripherals, as he wrote. It's the first operating system that will allow us to rent meat sacks in the sometime future of the late 21st century. In other words, controlling something happening elsewhere with the mind alone. Very interesting. And, you know, Caleb, you brought this up before we went to air. I hadn't intended to talk about this, but again, the story is that researchers from the University of Washington had announced that they'd established what they called direct brain-to-brain connections between a pair of people in a similar fashion, utilizing a video game like this. This was announced in the journal PLOS 1, or PLOS 1, on November 5th. Gentlemen, I don't think you guys differ very much in your attitudes toward the discussion of singularity, but you know, I mean, I'd be interested in getting your thoughts about this, because where he's going with this and what he's talking about in relation to the way that this will be related to the peripheral, this cyberpunk offering by William Gibson, is in the future where essentially we can utilize our minds to control another physical body, or maybe essentially create avatars, the likes of which, of course, in James Cameron's film, or James Cameron.
Yeah, James Cameron. I mean, I read the article earlier, you know, and there were a few things that I actually disagreed with a little bit in there, because they got into this discussion about how there's kind of like this immediate euphoria that people started to get once the quote unquote Facebook culture kind of came into reality, and people were getting reconnected with people, but they claimed very shortly after the Facebook boom, people started to kind of become disenchanted, and they felt more and more lonely as they realized that their connections with people on social media were not exactly, they weren't real, and they were all just a virtual simulation and blah, blah, blah. And I can't help but point out the fact that there is an overwhelming, overtly negative tone about our emergence into a technological culture. And I think it's easy for people to demonize technology because it is foreign to us. We don't necessarily know what the lasting social repercussions might potentially be. But I feel like going into something, anything, a giant change is far as what I think is happening technologically, I think going into that with a negative attitude is an incredibly irresponsible approach. I think we obviously need to be cautious, but I think that getting or finding out that we can literally send and receive potential telepathic brainwaves, I mean, that is an incredibly, incredibly profound discovery. And the fact that it's being brushed or just not being reported just kind of blows my mind, frankly.
I agree. The clock's about to catch us, but Chris, before we do, go ahead.
I mean, I agree almost entirely with what Caleb said. My only issue would be, as far as controlling an avatar, that's, you know, I guess a living death sort of for me.
Well, I mean, you know, what if it's an avatar you could step into and out of when you so choose? Like, for instance, and this is what's kind of odd, but what if the avatar is a robot that you control on a virtual battlefield where you can carry out, like, literally, I mean, you know, 300 type stuff or William Wallace type stuff. You can reenact historical battles and play the part of a character where you actually are controlling an avatar.
But you're then still dependent on your biological body being alive somewhere, right?
But think about this.
Yes, yes, yes.
Think about controlling these technological avatars on a moon base, on a Mars base, helping to build civilizations up there on planets. If our planet, as environmentalists say, is dying at the rate it actually is, if we're needing to build civilizations on other planets, why are we not implementing this technology now? Where's the funding for this?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Yeah, we wouldn't necessarily have to travel to another planet. We could use avatars to do it for us. Or, again, in the long term, and a lot of people consider this to be a serious ethical problem, but in the event that in the future we are able to replicate aspects of or the entire body, you literally are reaching or nearing death, and you could actually inhabit another body, which that is really disturbing to a lot of people. But again, bringing us full circle, this is essentially kind of what happens, although it's an organic process, which Doctor Who undergoes with every time he regenerates. Now, I do want to say really quickly before we go to break that Red Pill Junkie threw up in the chat room. And I do want to mention
this. We'll clean that up very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. He linked in the chat room an article that he actually posted today at dailygrail.com. And that is titled Help Fund Dr. Diane Powell's Telepathy Project. People in the chat room can see it right there. We'll have that linked up tomorrow at Grailian Daily News for November 11th. But I do want to point out that this is, again, Diane Powell, MD, a practicing psychiatrist and neuroscientist trained at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, who also taught neuropsychiatry at Harvard. And unlike most of her colleagues, had a long-time interest, RPJ writes, in the mystery of human consciousness and was skeptical of the materialist model of how the brain is the sole generator of the mind. She's undertaking a telepathy project, and it sounds like she's probably espousing the right kind of skepticism, so check that out at Daily Grail. We'll have that linked up at the Grailian Daily News. And of course, you know, Red Pill Junkie's got a regular blog that he writes over there. You might want to check that out while you're there just as well. When we come back, we're going to get around to the Michael Shermer's life-changing paranormal experience. RPJ, you're listening, I know, and you're going to love this one. I think everyone else out there will, too. I'm Micah Hanks with the Grailian Gang. It is the Grailian Report. We'll be back after this.
This is the Grailian Report, the unusual,
Weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Broadcasting live from the dark heart of the Appalachian Mountains, I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Grillion Report, along with Caleb Hanks and Chris Hayes. Oh, the wonderful Chris Hayes with his glorious red beard. There he is.
My face is on fire, everybody.
You're like a lumberjack pirate hybrid.
It's good having him around. Having that guy, he's really mean looking. He's big. He's got, you know, he's got tattoos all over his arms. He's swilling bourbon sitting over there. But he gives
the best darn hugs.
He gives the best. He is really one of the sweetest guys in the world, and we're very blessed to have him. We're blessed to have everybody out there who's listening live, and of course, help us propagate the message of what we do to the masses. This message has to get to the masses, and the only way you can reach them is through listeners like you. Tell folks about the daily news that you can actually subscribe to via RSS feed at graylionreport.com. Of course, we've got the podcast. We've got the additional subscriber content. This time of the year, you know, if you're thinking about a Christmas present for something and or for somebody, we don't discriminate, so some things and somebody's equally. Space aliens, we don't care. But, you know, you might even tell them, or even better, you might gift them with a subscription to Graylion X, which you can find at graylionreport.com/X, our subscriber portal, which brings people right on down to the bunker where you can get additional content, which include an additional weekly podcast with yours truly, as well as occasional co-hosts and specialty features. We also have the Graylion Enigmas and stuff that all these guys right here contribute to. We really enjoy it and appreciate all your support. So check that out online. I've been teasing this entire program a story that was actually sent along to me by Jessica Wozniak, I believe is how you pronounce your last name. I hope I get that right. I've been renowned for at times mispronunciating people's last names, and we don't want to mispronunciate anything here. But Jessica posted this online today and sent it to me, so thank you if you're listening, Jessica, so much for sending this along. Truly appreciated. And the story is, of course, that Michael Shermer reportedly had his own paranormal experience. Now, I have to say this about Michael Shermer. A lot of people don't like him. The article that actually carried this that was at collectiveevolution.com noted the way that Shermer has, you know, taken a very dismissive attitude toward things like UFOs in the past, and he certainly has. But for those of you out there who are not of the skeptical ilk, which, I mean, I consider myself to be as every much as, you know, a bit a part of, you shake your head, Chris. Do you disagree?
You're the pandering skeptic. We all know it.
Yes, that's right. Yes, of course.
According, the people's skeptic.
I'm the people's skeptic, so saith Jason Colavito. Yes, I'm the guy who is the, he's just skeptical enough to pander to the believers and basically feed them conspiracy and mysterious stuff, so that I can obviously make millions of dollars doing this. That's why I'm so rich. That's obviously, you guys know how rich I am, by the way, which is why we're in a fallout shelter that was apportioned during God knows what war. Hasn't been in use.
Did you say tax shelter? I think you said that wrong.
I said fallout shelter. Oh. Yeah, well, anyway, yeah. No, I mean, truly, I think that the problem is that when you become so skeptical, and this is what's interesting, is that with this story, there's a resolution at the end that I think offers some interesting insights into becoming too skeptical. You can become so skeptical that you close your mind to everything. And I generally don't engage Jason Colavito for that very reason, because he's so skeptical that you're never going to change somebody's mind like that. I am very much a skeptic, but when I am faced with something that appears to represent something that is either anomalous or of interest to those who would, you know, again, evoke terms like Fortiana, the unexplained, UFOs, cryptozoology. If there's something that seems to actually have evidence that warrants further inquiry, as even Carl Sagan had espoused in The Demon Haunted World on page 300-something, as, you know, Daryl pointed out earlier, Darren, I mean, you know, that is a good example of how, again, someone who was often considered the arch skeptic, Sagan, had said, yeah, but there are some paranormal phenomena, or seemingly paranormal phenomena, that at very least warrants further inquiry. Now, Michael Shermer, again, is a prominent skeptic, and he has often been criticized for the very, you know, derogatory kind of attitude that he takes toward UFOs and UFO believers and other such things. But some are saying he may have had a change of heart. An article that had been titled Infrequencies, that had apparently been featured not only in Scientific American, but in other outlets as well, recounted an experience that he had that apparently took place in June of this year. Just shortly, actually, after the last time Kilby and I saw Jessica. And he wrote, this is the salient point here, that the event took place on June 25th, 2014. On that day, I married Jennifer Groff from Köln, Germany. She had been raised by her mom. Her grandfather, Walter, was the closest father figure she had growing up, but he died when she was 16. Now, in shipping her belongings to my home before the wedding, most of the boxes were damaged and several precious heirlooms were lost, including her grandfather's binoculars. However, his 1978 Philips 70 transistor radio arrived safely, so I set out to bring it back to life after decades of muteness. Now, I put in new batteries, I opened it up to see if there were any loose connections to solder, I even tried percussive maintenance, said to work on such devices, which essentially involves smacking it sharply against a hard surface, but still silence. So we gave up, and I put it at the back of a desk drawer in our bedroom. Now, 3 months later, after affixing the necessary signatures to our marriage license at the Beverly Hills Courthouse, we returned home and, in the presence of my family, said our vows and exchanged rings. Being 9,000 kilometers from family, friends, and home, Jennifer was feeling amiss and a little lonely. She wished her grandfather were there to be able to give her away, and she whispered that she wanted to say something to me alone, so we excused ourselves to the back of the house, where we noticed we could hear music playing up in the bedroom. Well, we don't have a music system there, so we searched for laptops or iPhones and even opened the back door to check if the neighbors might have been playing music that we could be hearing. We followed the sound all the way to the printer on the desk, wondering absurdly if this combined printer, scanner, fax machine had maybe also included a radio, but that certainly wasn't the case. Now, at that moment, Jennifer shot me a look I haven't seen since that supernatural thriller The Exorcist startled audiences. "That can't be what I think it is, can it?" she said. She opened the desk drawer and pulled out her grandfather's transistor radio, out of which a romantic love song wafted. We sat in stunned silence for minutes. And she said, "My grandfather's here with us." She said it tearfully. "I'm not alone." Now, shortly thereafter, we returned to our guests with the radio playing as I recounted the backstory. My daughter, Devon, who came out of her bedroom just before the ceremony began, added, "I heard the music coming from your room just as you were about to start. The odd thing is that we were here getting ready just minutes before that time, and there hadn't been any music." Now, later that night, we fell asleep to the sound of classical music still emanating from Walter's radio. Fittingly, it stopped working the very next day and has remained silent ever since. Now, Michael Shermer, in this story, apparently added this at the very end. "The emotional interpretations of such anomalous events grant them significance regardless of their causal account. If we are to take seriously the scientific credo to keep an open mind and remain agnostic when the evidence is indecisive or the riddle unsolved, we should not shut the doors of perception when they may be opened to us to marvel in the mysterious." I thought that was a rather poignant statement. And I think that, again, it just goes to show that from time to time, the Michael Shermers of the world, or the Carl Sagans of the world, men, I think, who believe in doing good, and by espousing necessary skepticism are trying to preach that message. You know, I've never demonized those men for their skepticism, and I'm friends with a lot of people in the skeptical community. As I've said in the past, there are others who I wouldn't call enemies, but I'm certainly not friends with them because of the kind of skepticism that they espouse. But that point, again, the emotional interpretations of such anomalous events grant them significance regardless of their causal account. In other words, you know, we don't have to have an explanation for this. This doesn't have to be direct proof of granddad listening from beyond for us to attribute an incredible emotional significance to it. A synchronicity, in essence, guys.
Well, here's another look at it, though, too. Like, any kind of... It's obviously an odd situation that this happened. If you are a paranormal investigator, if you are just somebody that is a student of the oddity that is synchronistic happenings, it's noteworthy. It is something to be documented. It's something to take in consideration because there might be some sort of scientific element about this that later on we can attribute to, I don't know, heightened emotional... crowd-based mind nodes or you know, just craziness like that.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's the interesting thing is that the synchronicity factor is something that's always interested me. People always, for instance, you know, again, I almost hate to have to bring it up again, but, you know, Doctor Who. People always say, "Oh, you must be a long time..." You know, Lindsay Morrison and I having dinner the other night actually said that. She said, "You must have been watching this your whole life." And I was like, not at all. I started last October, and the only reason was because people kept saying I reminded them of this character. So I finally just wanted to see what it was all about, and I was amazed at when watching the program, the number of synchronicities, literally every time I watch it, that pop up. And I, the way I see this is that, as Dr. Kirby Surprise said in his book, Synchronicity, we tried to get him on the show a while back, and we may have to try and do that yet again, because, again, he is something of an authority on this subject. We just weren't successful getting him the first go-around, but I've got the book. And in that book, Dr. Kirby Surprise said that, basically, you see something that occurs in your world, in your space-time bubble, and you attribute the meaning, the meaningfulness to it. And that is the essence of what synchronicity is and how it works. And whether or not there's some sort of a weird mystical, although I think at times that there could be, but whether or not we can prove, I should say, scientifically, that there's some sort of a spiritual resonation, you know, or some sort of a resonance of some sort that's happening, and that you are actually experiencing some sort of a flux in the ether of space and time, and some sort of an intelligent matrix is communicating with you and your consciousness, whether or not we can prove that, there is an emotional significance that happens in the fact that these coincidences occur that makes them meaningful to us as individuals. That can't be overlooked. I don't think it can be overlooked. And that's why I've often said that my own personal experiences, rather than looking at things in terms of telepathy and ESP and precognition, I don't think I have precognitive experiences. I think I have numerous synchronicities. And Chris, you also, a man of, I think you're probably, in terms of skepticism, about as equivalent to my ideological sort of skepticism, or what I would like to call a non-ideological skepticism, as anyone. Have you had in your life meaningful kinds of synchronicities like that happen that you doubted but that you couldn't ignore?
Nothing that I would call incredibly, you know, meaningful on a personal level.
Yeah.
I mean, it happens more and more frequently as I grow older, and I feel like that's because I know of the concept, so I notice it more. There are some experiences that are more, I guess, important to me than others, but nothing on a deep personal level that would, anything even near like what was experienced with the transistor radio.
You know, another interesting point I was going to make, by the way, about this was that there was a comment in particular that was posted following Shermer's article by a fellow who identified himself as Mark. And he wrote the following, and I thought that this is why I thought it was interesting to point out the difference between skepticism and, or maybe an ideological kind of skepticism versus one that tries to avoid, oh, I'm a part of a club and therefore I disbelieve things or believe certain things because it helps me fit into this club. That's the kind of ideological skepticism I warn about. But the comment that was made by this fellow named Mark is pretty interesting. He says, Michael, I was embarrassed to read your concluding paragraph, the one about the emotional interpretations and the like. He says, what are we to keep an open mind about? That Jennifer's dead grandfather maybe fixed the radio? Did he even know how to fix radios? Wouldn't there be an easier way for the dead to communicate with the living? It would be mildly interesting to have an electronics expert determine exactly what's wrong with the radio. Again, what is it about certain people that they think that they have to take such a condescending attitude when challenging somebody's apparent ideological predisposition toward belief? Now, Michael Shermer, of all people, would be the last person who would have an ideological predisposition toward belief. A man who has been not only a founder and a game changer in the skeptic movement, but a guy also who has been someone who has, you know, become the poster child for skepticism, especially in the Western world. Not the kind of guy who's going to be probably prone to belief, but when he had this experience and chose to write about it, to try and connect a little bit with people out there. You know, even he isn't sacred in terms of that kind of, you know, criticism. Michael, I was embarrassed to read your concluding paragraph. What are we to keep an open mind about?
Well, I think that's honestly kind of a hilarious criticism because he kind of seems to take the authority that he knows what a dead person would be capable of in questioning, does he even know how to fix a radio? I think that's kind of silly, but I was thinking about how you were talking about these potential mind matrices and things like that. I always try to take it back to our understanding of technology, of what became technology before we understood it, our understanding of what electricity was before we were able to encapsulate that and utilize it to transform modern day living. We already know that we're finding things like Wi-Fi transmission, I mean, like radio waves. Before we knew what radio was, it was this invisible transmitting ability floating around in the air. who's to say that there aren't more powerful, invisible ways of communication that are just, we haven't found them because we don't have the technology yet?
Of course, that's a good question, one that needs to be brought to mind. And of course, I think that you know, no one can explain that better than Konstantin Radive. I won't play the audio, but you remember we've played it before on the program numerous times.
The man with the melting mouth.
Yes, exactly. The guy who purportedly actually had, oh hell, what the hell. We will play just a little bit of it.
Morning, this is George Meek.
This is Konstantin Radive.
That purportedly the voice of a spirit communicating from beyond the grave via telephone to George Meek back in like the 1980s.
Who is also a totus lycanthropus, or a weir toad.
Yeah, it might have been. Chris, you hadn't heard that before?
I've never heard that.
Yeah, that was an EVP, a purported EVP. See, what it was George Meek was an EVP researcher. And he, we played that a few times on the program. It might have been while you were in captivity. But he lived right over here, where George Meek did, right over in Franklin. He was from around here, and he had actually received phone calls that he believed were actually from spirits, and so he hooked up a recorder to his telephone so that he could record such conversations if and when they happened. And when he got a telephone call one morning that he suspected might be, I don't know, from beyond, he hit record and, hello, this is George Meek, and then he hears that Konstantin Radive, who had been another prominent EVP researcher who had recently been deceased. Now, I think he was punked.
That's... In a scale of 1 to convenient, that's probably beyond convenient.
Yeah, but it is spooky, and I have to pander just a little bit to the mysterious people out there, you know, so that they'll want to listen to the show, since that's what we do if we're you know, not really, really, you know, skeptical skeptics. So, but then what do we call Michael Shermer? You know, if he's willing to entertain the idea that he at least attached, if he didn't acknowledge that Granddad managed to communicate like Bumblebee style with music through the radio, at very least he seemed to attach an emotional significance to that experience, to that event. What are we to think of a man, again, a prominent American skeptic, who would espouse such nonsense? Actually, I commend him for being brave enough to talk about it. You know, another person who's done the same thing is Sharon Hill, who talks about, look, I'm a skeptic, but I'll go to a UFO event and I'll sit in the back of the room and I'll listen. And who are we to accuse these people of lying? Who are we to say that these people didn't have these? What right do we have not to say, or rather to say, that these people did not have these experiences? You know, you can be skeptical, but you have to also be able to be listened. You have to be able to listen. You have to be able to be human. You've got to be willing to step aside from what you think you know and your beliefs, and you have to be willing to accept possibilities. If we didn't at least accept from time to time possibilities, we wouldn't have science. We wouldn't have any ability to accumulate new knowledge and learn, because we would think we knew everything. And unfortunately, there are some people out there who are already well down that road themselves. They do think they know everything. Step away from the game, at least for long enough to see that there is a whole world of possibility out there. And when we come back, that possibility, unfortunately, that we're going to be looking into has to do with mind control. When we return here on the Graylian Report. Back, it is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, along with Chris Hayes and Caleb Hanks. No relation, we just have the same last name.
Dr. Hayes.
Yes, I'm the only doctor in this room, thank you, actually, although this man has a double major in religious studies and anthropology, which is part of the reason we like having him around. and why it was so fitting that you would spend a little time with the Hadals, being the anthropologist among us here.
I learned from them.
I became one. Before we get into the discussion of mind control, I do want to point out, I get so many queries from people out there in the listenership lately about my personal life. Nothing creepy, but people always want to know, is there a Mrs. Hanks? Do you have, I mean, what do you do? Do you do stuff outside of, like, the Graylian Report? Well, no. Yeah, there is one thing, middle theory. I play music. Caleb and I travel around playing bluegrass and old-time music. No, there is no Mrs. Hanks.
Except for Mom.
Well, there's Mom, but yes, right now the doctor travels alone. But that's okay. I prefer it that way, at least for the time being. Another thing, my friend Venus and I were talking, and she'd asked a question. She says, I listen to your podcast, and why is it that you have such a southern accent, and yet your brother's is non-existent? Like I said, same last name, no relation. I don't claim this kid.
I was just over here practicing my A's. Does this look like an A to you?
And what's funny is when we perform, Caleb's the one that sings most of the Elvis songs, but everybody says, Micah, you sound like Elvis.
I don't sound like Elvis when I sing him. I just happen to know a few.
You sing him, yeah, exactly. Yeah, but everybody wants to hear me sing Elvis. With a one for the money, a two for the show, a three get a red and I'll go cat go, but don't you level my blue.
Yeah. Straight from the horse's patoot here, people.
We could go all night. We'll just stop right there. Now I'll never hear the end of it, especially our UK listeners. They're the ones that really love the Elvis. One of them actually said, you could literally move over here to London and you could be an Elvis impersonator and you'd be rich and famous. And I'm thinking, exactly what I want to be rich and famous and known for doing.
Being a second-rate version of somebody else.
Hey, all you got to do is make all the money. Sell out long enough to be able to do what you want to do with the rest of your life. I mean, I'm just saying, come on over here. Just, you got to go get the money. You get the money. You have the freedom to do what you want to do.
Listen, guys, I could be living in high society with a very nice mansion right now if I pursued my Gilbert Gottfried impersonation, my career as a Gilbert Gottfried impersonator. I could be working for Aflac right now.
Caleb, I don't even have to hypnotize you to make you do this. Before we get into a discussion of hypnotism, I think the people at home would enjoy this, actually, and I condone this right now. I'd like to hear your Gilbert, please.
Gotta get into character here.
Go ahead, yeah. Meditate for a minute.
So it was me and Keith Moon breaking into a little sweet shop on the edge of town to try to get 1,000 brown M&Ms to fill a brandy glass.
I really think he does a rather good Gilbert Godfrey.
I have to get louder, but I don't want to max out the soundboard.
And I really think you might. Okay, well, so character acting time at the Graylian Report is over officially. But it's funny because in the realms of mind control, there are different attitudes about all this. As a matter of fact, in modern psychology, there is the idea that you do have different selves, that there are different aspects of yourself maybe that exist. And in certain areas of therapeutic practice, it has been believed that certain selves, I guess, can retreat into the subconscious and maybe carry with them memories. Things that actually happened but have long been lost. Now, there was a story that PS Mag had carried recently, and the story basically was talking about this treatment center in St. Louis called Castlewood. And the story had gone that was reported was talking about how this man identified as Tom. His daughter had been admitted. I think that he and his wife had split up, if memory serves, and Anna, his daughter, had been admitted because once she got to her teens, she started losing weight. She started becoming rather withdrawn. They sent her to this treatment center. And this location, Castlewood, had apparently engaged in the practice of trying to recover what they called, they wanted to try and regain recovered memories that had been suppressed from some time previously. What they believed had happened was that Anna had things happen in her past that she had repressed, and they wanted to try and gain access to these recoverable or recovered memories, as they're sometimes referred to. And when they did so, Anna began to believe that Tom, her father, had actually sexually assaulted her when she was younger. Now, it turns out that there were two other women who came forward, and then later two more, so at least four, possibly others, had also come forward and said that they were led to believe that they had gained access to these recovered memories by the people at the Castlewood Treatment Center. and that they had also similarly been led to believe that a family member or someone had early in life mistreated them or assaulted them, when in fact none of these memories were indeed true or accurate representations of what had happened in their past. And they sued, I believe. And this is actually something that's happened numerous times in the past, not just with Castlewood. The whole idea of recovered memories and the fact that people who claim to have had memories recovered later begin to dispute whether or not what was told to them is indeed an actual experience, an actual remembrance, versus a fabricated memory. Now, this PS Mag article presents some rather salient points that I want to issue here. Now, though therapeutic accounts of repressed memories appear as far back as the days of Sigmund Freud, it was during the mid-20th century that they garnered popular attention. For instance, in 1957, that was what was called The Three Faces of Eve, a pseudo-biographical novel that was actually written by two psychiatrists, presented the case study of a woman who purportedly had severe gaps in her memory as a result of a traumatic childhood experience that she had had. Now, later, Flora Schreiber's Sybil, a book that many people out there in the listening audience will remember, retold psychiatrist Cornelia Wilbur's journey with the then anonymous patient Shirley Mason and the uncovering of Mason's suppressed history of abuse by her mother. Starting to sound familiar, doesn't it? Unfortunately, this would by no means be the last time it would happen, as history has shown, with an Emmy-winning television adaptation coming shortly after the book's publication in 1973. Sybil captivated the public's imagination. Before long, the belief that memories of abuse could disappear from consciousness right after the abuse happened and stay hidden for decades, only to be retrieved intact during miraculous bouts with therapists, became accepted wisdom both with the general public and many in the mental health community. In other words, these experimental therapeutic practices, later popularized in popular films and books that were written about these things, loosely based, probably at best, on these experiences, led to the idea that it was widely accepted in the public that these kind of things could happen and that recovered memories could be accessed and that virtually anybody could have things that happened in their past that they didn't know about, but that it could be recovered later utilizing things like hypnosis. This new theory of how the mind reacted to trauma gained so much momentum from the growing cultural acceptance that sexual abuse had long been underestimated and ignored. And now, that is actually probably true. Sexual abuse is probably often underreported. In fact, I'm almost certain that's the case. But the idea of there being recoverable memories that in truth may actually be introduced rather than recovered is indeed troubling, I think. In addition to the vast array of symptoms ascribed to early repressed trauma, depression, anorexia, the lingering sensations of pain, some psychologists also believed it was able to spawn independent personalities just as well, not just character acting like Caleb and Chris and I were doing here a moment ago. Now, these personalities are alters which could instantly take over the patient's consciousness and wall off memories from each other, or the manifestation of what was then called multiple personality disorder, which was indeed a condition still recognized back in the 1980s in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders. Now, I think that multiple personalities, there are different jurisdictions. I think that there is dissociative personality disorder or borderline dissociative personality disorder. There are different things, but I don't think that multiple personality disorder is still recognized. Now, a significant portion of the mental health community, by one estimate, in the mid-1990s, more than 50,000 U.S. therapists, appeared at that time to accept repressed memories uncritically. A subset of them also promoted the notion that murderous satanic cults were in fact common and responsible for the client's forgotten pasts. And hence seminars in which practicing therapists offered advice on how best to retrieve said memories of cult abuse from their clients began to be held all around the country. And a typical example of the memories that therapists said that they were uncovering could be seen in the 1980 autobiography Michelle Remembers. This one's a pretty graphic one. It was written by Lawrence Pasder, a Canadian psychiatrist, and his patient, who later he ended up marrying, I should note, named Michelle Smith. Smith described a satanic organization that she claimed tortured her for months, that had fed her soup laced with worms and all kinds of things that you'd expect in a horror movie, and that they'd made her witness animal sacrifices just as well. Even when they didn't extend to the demonic, the sessions of now specialized trauma experts almost always centered on recollections of incest and sexual abuse. What's interesting is, if I remember correctly, I think that in the case of Michelle Smith, that later she found that, well, you know, she didn't think that these things that were purported to have occurred, according to her therapist and husband, Michelle didn't seem to really remember any of that later on down the road, and later disputed it, and actually, I think, even settled in court as a result. But this idea that there are so many things, I mean, again, I want to come back to some of the books and some of the celebrities that have talked about this. The PS Mag article actually talks about this. America had been captivated by the phenomenon, weaving it into popular culture. Daytime talk shows like Geraldo held regular interviews with victims who claimed to have recovered memories themselves. We had celebrities like Roseanne Barr disclosing their own experiences of repressed trauma. Books like The Courage to Heal, A Guide for Women Survivors of Child Sexual Abuse and Secret Survivor, another book, Uncovering Incest and the After Effects in Women, listed hundreds of symptoms that were supposedly proof of having repressed memories. And these books became bestsellers. Now, I don't want to say that it's impossible that a person could actually have repressed memories. But, you know, we played a show, Nitrograss, my band, the other night. And after the band had left, I was wrapping things up and kind of breaking down the PA. And I went up to the bar and was going to tip the people who had been serving us beverages all night. And one of the ladies who worked there said, "Caleb told me, by the way, last month you weren't able to be here because you were out of town speaking at a conference." And I said, "Oh, yeah, that was the Paradigm Symposium." And she leaned in and kind of winked at me, and she said, "I think I've been abducted, too." And I said, "Oh, you have? By who? Who did it?" And she said, "No, I mean, you know," and she pointed up. She said, "Aliens. I think I've been abducted." Now, maybe somebody actually has been. It's not my place to say that someone has or has not been abducted by aliens, but I was interested in what she was saying and I asked, "Well, what do you recall?" And she said that she didn't remember anything, but that she just had weird experiences that led her to believe that maybe she had actually had these experiences in relation to something maybe ufological in nature. Now, a question. Let's say that you think that you may have had weird experiences in your life, and you say, "I'm going to go to a hypnotist, and I'm going to see if there was something alien-oriented with it." What do you think would happen if you sit down with a hypnotist and you say, "I would like to be regressed"? You don't even tell the hypnotist what you think is happening, but you say, "I want to just see what happens." What kind of a narrative do you think is going to come out? The hypnotist takes you back. "Okay, let's go to that night in 1980. You think something weird happened to you. Remember, let's go back to that moment. 3, 2, 1. What happened?"
I think on a personal level, better than saying what I think would happen, because I have honestly no idea, I'd like to have it done. Let's do it.
You know what?
We should have someone regress me with no prior knowledge.
Let's do it on the air.
On film, on the air.
But you
make
know
it
what?
A Graylian X offering.
I feel like I really know exactly how that's going to go down. Is you're going to go under, and the doc's going to be like, "All right, what are you seeing?" And Chris is going to be like, it's dark. There's dripping water. It's cold. There's
Hadles.
There's Hadle babies everywhere.
Potatoes everywhere.
Potato people.
I've been locked in the root cellar for years.
He's going to remember what actually happened to him. I'll tell you this, though, all seriousness. When our buddies from Who Forted came down a couple of years ago, and Greg and Dana and Jason and, you know, when they came down, it wasn't Nick. It was Nick Faust was the other guy that was with him. But Jason had actually been the one who had undergone, as part of the documentary film that they were making, a regression. And he had said, I've never had anything like that happen. So they say, well, let's just see what happens. And he does exactly what Chris has just posited there. He sits down basically for a cold hypnotism session. And the hypnotist takes him back and says, okay, what happened that night? And all of a sudden, lo and behold, Jason ends up spewing forth this entire abduction scenario. And he became so frantic during the scenario that they had to bring him out of it. And he said, I knew that none of this had ever happened, but in that moment under hypnosis, you couldn't have convinced me I was not being abducted by aliens. It was all so real. And he said, I was terrified. And they have this apparently on camera. Greg was telling me the scariest part was us all standing there, Nick and Dana and I, watching him freaking out and recounting this non-existent alien abduction.
Why does it always default to alien abduction and past lives and things like that? Why can't it be something weird and scarring in your real life past? Why can't you be hypnotized and real things come out? Why does it always have to be suggestions?
Maybe it could be. I think that's the point that should be made, Chris, is that I don't want to say, you know, I don't think that hypnotism is very reliable. I don't think it's a very safe way to try and determine something that may have happened in somebody's past. But again, notice that there have been different periods where there have been kind of cultural motifs that begin to emerge, and people who claim to have been, you know, able to access these repressed memories periodically tend to follow trends. You know, there have been times where it's alien abduction. There was the satanic panic where so many young women believed that they were actually the abused victims of satanic cults. More recently, Caleb, you and I have interviewed people who have claimed to have been super soldiers who were taken underground to bases and facilities where they were actually trained to be psychics or trained to be mind warriors or trained to actually be super soldiers that would go out there on the battlefield if needed. You know, it's so little as a telephone call with a hypnotic suggestion that would put them into one of these disassociated states of mind where they would literally take on a whole different personality and become a quote-unquote super soldier.
Let's look at a few things here, and I'm not saying I'm debunking this or this is what hypnosis actually is, but think about this. When you go into a hypnotic state, it is a potential dreamlike state. Now, I think
an altered state
of
consciousness.
Altered state. Yeah. It's a more relaxed, heading towards the realm of sleep. Anybody that has ever experienced a lucid dream, it seems incredibly real while you're there. You know, any kind of dream can seem like you're actually in that state. And when you wake up, sometimes it takes a while to shake that because you feel like you actually had that experience. Who is to say that this is not... I mean, it sounds to me like almost the exact same thing. But in the case of hypnosis, it just sounds like somebody is guiding you.
Yeah. It sounds like the same experience that would be had if you... If you underwent the Gansfield technique.
Oh, wow.
With the ping pong balls?
Yeah, with the ping pong balls. Yeah. Say at the light center.
Yeah.
I'll bring the camera.
Could be done. I've actually experienced the Gansfield technique, you know, and I think really if you were in the right state of mind, you could see damn near anything you wanted to see under those circumstances. But, you know, I think it is interesting that, there have been these cultural kind of trends that follow the people who undergo hypnosis, whether it be alien abduction, whether it be the satanic ritual abuse victims, you know, the super soldiers, probably any number of... Yeah, Chris, really, I mean, the past life regression, same sort of thing.
Well, think about this. How many times has a hypnotic regression, an actual hypnotic regression gone in where the person that was administering the hypnotic regression was trying to see if somebody had ever been pursued by zombies? I'm just saying.
Interesting, yeah.
I think it would be an interesting test to see if this person described in vague detail how other people describe alien abduction being pursued by zombies when obviously something of the like probably didn't happen.
Yeah.
It would be funny to see or interesting to see if you could get the exact same results, because honestly, I think you would.
The thing is that you're not supposed to, and I actually know certain practicing hypnotherapists, you're not supposed to in any way lead your patient.
The problem with that though is it's really almost impossible to not do that.
Yeah, and this is
no matter what question you ask, it can still be construed as a leading question.
Yeah, exactly, which is the entire problem with this. Now, as PS Mag had reported on this, the practice of memory recovery therapy rose to prominence, but skeptics, not just, you know, people like us would say, okay, look, maybe there's, you know, maybe not the family members who were convicted. I should note that when we talked about this at the outset, and we were talking about Tom, this character who's, you know, his daughter had gone to this Castlewood clinic, when the recovered memories seemed to indicate that he had possibly sexually assaulted his daughter early in her life, it wasn't a matter of, well, did this happen or did it not? He actually ended up having the charges were dropped. But he had to register as a potential sex offender. And he and his other daughter, by the way, and his wife all adamantly maintained, well, I don't know if his wife had or not, that's unclear, but I know that he had another daughter whom Anna had asked, did Dad ever, do you remember, touch you in an odd way or anything? And she said, absolutely not. The other daughter and the dad were both convinced that this had all been recovered memories that were actually implanted erroneously during these sessions at the Castlewood Clinic. How many other people, you know, especially in these claims of satanic panic, you know, how many other people have been erroneously and entirely wrongly labeled sex offenders as a result of what is believed to be a therapeutic practice gone wrong? Now, psychologist and memory expert Elizabeth Loftus, then at the University of Washington, was already an expert in how memory, particularly in the context of eyewitness testimony, was malleable to suggestion and social influence. To the point maybe that, yes, indeed, government agencies probably have experimented with this too. In fact, we know they have, MKUltra. Her studies suggested that people could be guided toward unequivocally false recollections. In 1994, she published a book It was called The Myth of Repressed Memories, False Memories and Allegations of Sexual Abuse, challenging the fundamental tenets of recovered memory therapy. People don't recall the past, she argued, but they reconstruct it, molding it to the demands and beliefs of the present moment. Therapists' assumptions that their clients held hidden memories of abuse, she asserted, could be a key factor in creating those very memories, i.e. unintending to lead someone, but doing it nonetheless.
All of this just, and I'm sick for thinking of all of it, all of this is just opening up so many possibilities of what I would love for you guys to do to me as part of the revamping of the old Project Believer.
Project Believer. Oh, God, it had to come down to this. Worse than MK Ultra, there was something that, talk about, Clara, am I a good man? No, because we actually had an idea a while back to put Chris through all kind of hell to make a believer of this skeptic here in the studio with us.
This wasn't the Super Soldier program where you were trying to turn him into Captain Apostrophe America, was it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Well, if living underground with you know, potato human hybrids isn't enough for you, Chris, I don't know what will make you believe. So I don't know that really there's going to be any merit to us reenacting Operation Believer.
I'm going to Google licensed hypnotists.
Oh, God. This is going to get dangerous.
Let's just find somebody on the street.
The thing is it already became dangerous, though. And this whole thing, there are people in the listening audience, no doubt, who feel that maybe they've actually had experiences of their own. And I'm not trying to say that if you've undergone hypnosis, you didn't actually have happen what you think happened. The point is, though, is that we have to recognize how susceptible the mind is to the influence of others when an induced altered state of consciousness, okay, has been made availed to the mind of the individual who presumes that they have had these experiences. Whatever they think may have happened to them, sadly, in likelihood, may not have happened. And the reason why is because if you can't remember it unless you are being assisted with that memory, that is probably the clearest evidence that the memory may not have occurred that I could imagine ever happening. And you've just got to accept the fact that really, I mean, the studies show that people's lives have been ruined as a result of this kind of a thing. It's fine to believe. It's fine to have experiences. But you just want to be careful in being honest with yourself and knowing for certain or as close to certain as you can that those experiences you had were your own. High mountains of Appalachia. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report. I want to thank our dear friends back in Fort Smith, Arkansas, Race Hobbs and the lovely Lady Bird, who are assisting with the reliable stream now carried at GraylianReport.com. That is courtesy of the one and only KGRA Global Radio, broadcast station. There we go. Flub that. Actually, I wonder if Hobbs is around right now. Hobbs, have I got you in there, buddy? He may have stepped away from his microphone for a moment. We'll get him back on here in a minute.
You got to do the Hobbs call. Hobbs, Hobbs.
That's right. Hobbs, 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 Hobbs. Hobbs, Hobbs. Yeah, I'm still not hearing him, so.
I think you frightened the wild Hobbs.
That's okay. I've frightened the wild Hobbs. It's okay. He's there sometimes. He's actually, that's the great thing about being able to do this program live on a radio network like this, is you've actually got an in-studio producer behind the scenes. It's not just us doing all this stuff. So, just goes to show that there's a lot going on behind the scenes with this program each week, and we're very thankful for it. Better for it, in fact, because the live listeners are able to have a more reliable stream, a much better chat room, and, of course, there are fewer hiccups to have to worry about. Even trickling down to the podcast, which we offer to you each week. And I want to point out to people, because there have been a few critics on iTunes who've actually brought this, they've raised this point. There have been people who have left negative reviews on iTunes because they say, oh, just like Mysterious Universe or any other show, these guys have started Graylian X and they're going to charge for all the good content. This program, when Chris and I launched the inaugural edition of this program, almost coming up on 4 years, Chris. I mean, it's been a long time since we've been doing this show. We've come a long way. The first one was just you and I. Matt Oakley joined us for a long time. Caleb joined us shortly after that. You know, you took a hiatus. You're back, thank God.
I remember it was back in June of 2011.
Was it?
Yes. Possibly May.
Yeah.
It might have been May.
Around that time. Point is that we've been doing this show for a very long time. And while a lot of things have changed, a lot of things have improved, too. But one thing that has not changed is the fact that this show is always a self-contained podcast. Nobody who listens to the Graylian Report is going to get anything less if they are not a Graylian X subscriber. This podcast is self-contained, and this is one thing I maintain has to be the case. One of the reasons we love the people at the KGRA is because they've bent over backwards to make it for us so that we can provide this podcast freely to the public. We can utilize the stream of this network, which we thank and that we believe in very much, and also so that we can continue to provide a self-contained podcast for people who enjoy what we do, for people who want to show support for what we do. $7 a month, you can subscribe to Graylian X. You get additional content, but everything you hear is self-contained. And so for the one or two reviews where people have said, oh, yeah, these guys are just like everybody else. You know, they're just going to charge for the good stuff. No, everything that we've always given you for free, you still get. If you want more, which we're willing to work our asses off for, you get that too. And that's it. And I think that that's the important point that needs to be made. And I should also say that when people compare us to Mysterious Universe, we support completely what Ben and Aaron and Wendy are doing down there. Ben Grundy is one of my dearest friends in the whole world. And, you know, I truly love all my Australian friends. But, you know, if it weren't for Ben, I probably wouldn't have so many friends in Australia. And what right should he not have, or anybody else who does a podcast, to be able to profit from the work that goes into it? Those guys work harder than anybody in this biz. You know, and for people out there who criticize anybody who wants to have a subscriber area on their websites, they forget how much work goes into this. But what we would do with the Graylian Report, aside of our, you know, from our support of Ben and Aaron or anybody else, you know, Cam and Kyle down there at Expanded Perspectives, Darren and Graham, Grimerica, we've got so many friends and loyal friends at that in the podcasting community, all of whom try to capitalize to an extent on what they're able to do. But they're, don't forget, people, all of you out there listening, don't forget the amount of free content that you get with these kind of programs. Don't forget the free streaming provided by the KGRA. Do you know how much money goes into being able to provide a live free stream for the public to be able to listen to 24/7, which is exactly what the KGRA does? They probably spend more than they make doing that, and they do it because we know that there is a service provided to the public that, for God's sake, we believe in.
For, I mean, if people think about it, the more, if they want more content like this, the only way that we can provide more of it is if we actually did this as our jobs. And if people want to donate to the cause, that just means you get more content, and that's, you know, inevitably what we'd like to be able to do.
Absolutely, that is absolutely the truth. And so with that in mind, we've got to wrap things up here. But, you know, again, I want to thank everybody out there who does support what we do. Whether you support us at the Graylian Report, whether you're a subscriber to Graylian X, if you're a subscriber at KGRARadio.com, if you're a live listener, or if you're someone who sends us along news from time to time, info@GraylianReport.com. Guys, we appreciate all of you, every one. And on behalf of Caleb Hanks, Chris Hayes, Matthew Oakley, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, Jeremy London, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, the mouth of the South, the doctor, down here in the dungeon we call the Graylian Bunker, we bring you news and our closest approximation of the truth. Each week, it is the Graylian Report. We bid you adieu now. And as always, friends, stay strange. We'll talk to you again next week.
Been listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website GraylianReport.com.